Chapter 83. Which is all about the law, and sundry great authorities learned therein, scattered about, in various holes and corners of the temple, are certain dark and dirty chambers, in and out of which, all the morning in vacation, and half the evening to in term time, there may be seen constantly hurrying with bundles of papers under their arms, and protruding from their pockets, an almost uninterrupted succession of lawyers' clerks. There are several grades of lawyers' clerks. There is the articled clerk, who has paid a premium, and is an attorney in perspective, who runs a tailor's bill, receives invitations to parties, knows a family in Gower Street, and another in Tavistock Square, who goes out of town every long vacation to see his father, who keeps live horses innumerable, and who is, in short, the very aristocrat of clerks. There is the salaried clerk out of door, or in door, as the case may be, who devotes the major part of his 30 shillings a week to his personal pleasure and adornments, repairs half price to the Adelphi Theatre at least 3 times a week, dissipates majestically at the cider cellars afterwards, and is a dirty caricature of the fashion which expired 6 months ago. There is the middle-aged copying clerk, with a large family, who is always shabby, and often drunk. And there are the office lads in their first surtouts, who feel a befitting contempt for boys at day schools, club as they go home at night, for saveloys and porter, and think there's nothing like life. Apostrophe, there are varieties of the genus, too numerous to recapitulate, but however numerous they may be, they are all to be seen, at certain regulated business hours, hurrying to and from the places we have just mentioned. These sequestered nooks are the public offices of the legal profession, where writs are issued, judgments signed, declarations filed, and numerous other ingenious machines put in motion for the torture and torment of His Majesty's liege subjects, and the comfort and emolument of the practitioners of the law. They are, for the most part, low-roofed, moldy rooms, where innumerable rolls of parchment, which have been perspiring in secret for the last century, send forth an agreeable odor, which is mingled by day with the scent of the dry rot, and by night with the various exhalations which arise from damp cloaks, festering umbrellas, and the coarsest tallow candles. About 7:30 in the evening, some 10 days or a fortnight after Mr. Pickwick and his friends returned to London, there hurried into one of these offices an individual in a brown coat and brass buttons, whose long hair was scrupulously twisted round the rim of his napless hat, and whose soiled drab trousers were so tightly strapped over his blucher boots that his knees threatened every moment to start from their concealment. He produced from his coat pockets a long and narrow strip of parchment, on which the presiding functionary impressed an illegible black stamp. He then drew forth 4 scraps of paper, of similar dimensions, each containing a printed copy of the strip of parchment with blanks for a name, and having filled up the blanks, put all the 5 documents in his pocket, and hurried away. The man in the brown coat, with the cabalistic documents in his pocket, was no other than our old acquaintance Mr. Jackson, of the house of Dodson and Fogg, Freeman's Court, Cornhill. Instead of returning to the office whence he came, however, he bent his steps direct to Sun Court, and walking straight into the George and Vulture, demanded to know whether one Mr. Pickwick was within. "Call Mr. Pickwick's servant, Tom," apostrophe said the barmaid of the George and Vulture. "Don't trouble yourself," apostrophe said Mr. Jackson. "I've come on business. If he will show me Mr. Pickwick's room, I'll step up myself." "Apostrophe, what name, sir?" "Apostrophe," said the waiter. "Jackson," apostrophe replied the clerk. The waiter stepped upstairs to announce Mr. Jackson, but Mr. Jackson saved him the trouble by following close at his heels and walking into the apartment before he could articulate a syllable. Mr. Pickwick had, that day, invited his 3 friends to dinner. They were all seated round the fire, drinking their wine, when Mr. Jackson presented himself, as above described.
"How do, sir?"
" said Mr. Jackson, nodding to Mr. Pickwick. That gentleman bowed, and looked somewhat surprised, for the physiognomy of Mr. Jackson dwelt not in his recollection. "I have called from Dodson and Fox," " said Mr. Jackson, in an explanatory tone. Mr. Pickwick roused at the name. "I refer you to my attorney, sir, Mr. Perker, of Gray's Inn," " said he. "Waiter, show this gentleman out." "Beg your pardon, Mr. Pickwick," " said Jackson, deliberately depositing his hat on the floor and drawing from his pocket the strip of parchment. "But personal service, by clerk or agent, in these cases, you know, Mr. Pickwick, nothing like caution, sir, in all legal forms, eh?" Here Mr. Jackson cast his eye on the parchment, and, resting his hands on the table, and looking round with a winning and persuasive smile, said, "Now, come, don't let's have no words about such a little matter as this. Which of you gentlemen's name's Snodgrass?" At this inquiry, Mr. Snodgrass gave such a very undisguised and palpable start that no further reply was needed. "Ah, I thought so," " said Mr. Jackson, more affably than before. "I've a little something to trouble you with, sir. Exclaimed Mr. Snodgrass. "It's only a subpoena in Bartle and Pickwick on behalf of the plaintiff," " replied Jackson, singling out one of the slips of paper and producing a shilling from his waistcoat pocket. "It'll come on, in the sentence after term. 14th of February, we expect. We've marked it a special jury cause, and it's only 10 down the paper. That's yours, Mr. Snodgrass." As Jackson said this, he presented the parchment before the eyes of Mr. Snodgrass, and slipped the paper and the shilling into his hand. Mr. Tupman had witnessed this process in silent astonishment, when Jackson, turning sharply upon him, said, "I think I ain't mistaken when I say your name's Tupman, am I?" Mr. Tupman looked at Mr. Pickwick, but, perceiving no encouragement in that gentleman's widely opened eyes to deny his name, said, "Yes, my name is Tupman, sir. And that other gentleman's Mr. Winkle, I think?" said Jackson. Mr. Winkle faltered out a reply in the affirmative, and both gentlemen were forthwith invested with a slip of paper and a shilling each by the dexterous Mr. Jackson. "Now," said Jackson, "I'm afraid you'll think me rather troublesome, but I want somebody else, if it ain't inconvenient. I have Samuel Weller's name here, Mr. Pickwick. Send my servant here, waiter," said Mr. Pickwick. The waiter retired, considerably astonished, and Mr. Pickwick motioned Jackson to a seat. There was a painful pause, which was at length broken by the innocent defendant. "I suppose, sir," said Mr. Pickwick, his indignation rising while he spoke, "I suppose, sir, that it is the intention of your employers to seek to criminate me upon the testimony of my own friends?" Mr. Jackson struck his forefinger several times against the left side of his nose, to intimate that he was not there to disclose the secrets of the prison house, and playfully rejoined, "Not knowing, can't say." "For what other reason, sir," pursued Mr. Pickwick, "are these subpoenas served upon them, if not for this?" "Very good plant, Mr. Pickwick," replied Jackson, slowly shaking his head. "But it won't do. No harm in trying, but there's little to be got out of me." Here Mr. Jackson smiled once more upon the company, and, applying his left thumb to the tip of his nose, worked a visionary coffee mill with his right hand, thereby performing a very graceful piece of pantomime then much in vogue, but now, unhappily, almost obsolete, which was familiarly denominated taking a grinder. "No, Mr. Pickwick," " said Jackson, in conclusion, Turker's people must guess what we've served these subpoenas for. If they can't, they must wait till the action comes on, and then they'll find out. Apostrophe Mr. Pickwick bestowed a look of excessive disgust on his unwelcome visitor, and would probably have hurled some tremendous anathema at the heads of Messrs. Dodson and Fogg, had not Sam's entrance at the instant interrupted him. Samuel Weller? ... said Mr. Jackson, inquiringly. "'Vun know the truest things as you've said for many a long year, ... replied Sam, in a most composed manner. "'Here's a subpoena for you, Mr. Weller,' said Jackson. "'What's that in English?' inquired Sam. "'Here's the original,' said Jackson, declining the required explanation. ''Which?'' said Sam. ''This,'' replied Jackson, shaking the parchment. ''Oh, that's the original, is it?'' said Sam. ''Well, I'm worry glad I've seen the original, 'cause it's a gratifying sort o' thing, and eases one's mind so much.'' ''And here's the shilling,'' said Jackson. ''It's from Dodson and Fox.'' ''And it's uncommon handsome o' Dodson and Fogg, as knows so little of me, to come down with a present,'' said Sam. ''I feel it is a worry high compliment, sir. It's a worry honorable thing to them, as they knows how to reward merit wherever they meets it. Besides which, it's affectin' to one's feelings.'' As Mr. Weller said this, he inflicted a little friction on his right eyelid, with the sleeve of his coat, after the most approved manner of actors, when they are in domestic pathetics. Mr. Jackson seemed rather puzzled by Sam's proceedings. But, as he had served the subpoenas, and had nothing more to say, he made a feint of putting on the one glove which he usually carried in his hand, for the sake of appearances, and returned to the office to report progress. Mr. Pickwick slept little that night. His memory had received a very disagreeable refresher on the subject of Mrs. Bartle's action. He breakfasted at Bedham's next morning, and, desiring Sam to accompany him, set forth towards Gray's Inn Square. Sam! ... said Mr. Pickwick, looking round, when they got to the end of Cheapside. Sir? ... said Sam, stepping up to his master. Which way? ... up Newgate Street. Mr. Pickwick did not turn round immediately, but looked vacantly in Sam's face for a few seconds, and heaved a deep sigh. What's the matter, sir? ... inquired Sam. This action, Sam, said Mr. Pickwick, is expected to come on the 14th of next month. ... Remarkable coincidence that year, sir, replied Sam. Why remarkable, Sam? ... inquired Mr. Pickwick. Wellington's day, sir, responded Sam. Reglar good day for a breach o' promise trial. Mr. Weller's smile awakened no gleam of mirth in his master's countenance. Mr. Pickwick turned abruptly round, and led the way in silence. They had walked some distance, Mr. Pickwick trotting on before, plunged in profound meditation, and Sam following behind, with a countenance expressive of the most enviable and easy defiance of everything and everybody, when the latter, who was always especially anxious to impart to his master any exclusive information he possessed, quickened his pace until he was close at Mr. Pickwick's heels, and, pointing up at a house they were passing, said, "Worry nice pork shop that ere, sir." ... Yes, it seems so, said Mr. Pickwick. Celebrated sausage factory, said Sam. Is it? Said Mr. Pickwick. Is it? Reiterated Sam, with some indignation. I should rather think it was. Why, sir, bless your innocent eyebrows, that's where the mysterious disappearance of a spectable tradesman took place 4 years ago. ... You don't mean to say he was burked, Sam? " said Mr. Pickwick, looking hastily round. "No, I don't indeed, sir," replied Mr. Weller. "I wish I did. Far worse than that. He was the master o' that 'ere shop, sir, and the inwentor o' the patent never leavin' off Sassach steam engine, as 'ud swaller up a pavin' stone, if you put it too near, and grind it into sassages as easy as if it was a tender young babby. Worry proud o' that machine he was, as it was natural he should be, and he'd stand down in the cellar a-lookin' at it when it was in full play, till he got quite melancholy with joy. A worry happy man he'd ha' been, sir, in the procession o' that 'ere engine and two more lovely infants besides, if it hadn't been for his wife, who was a most audacious wixen. She was always a-follerin' him about, and dinnin' in his ears, till at last he couldn't stand it no longer. 'I'll tell you what it is, my dear,' he says one day, 'if you persevere in this here sort of amusement,' he says, 'I'm blessed if I don't go away to America.' And that's all about it. 'You're a idle willin,' says she, 'and I wish the Americans joy of their bargain.' Arter which she keeps on abusin' of him for half an hour, and then runs into the little parlor behind the shop, sets to a screamin', says he'll be the death on her, and falls in a fit, which lasts for 3 good hours, one o' them fits which is all screamin' and kickin'. Well, next mornin', the husband was missin'. He hadn't taken nothin' from the till, hadn't even put on his greatcoat, so it was quite clear he warn't gone to America." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.